I hope my wife doesn't hear this because she's going to hold me accountable to anything that I say. But the goal here is adding Kedusha to your Kedushin. I'm not just saying this when I say I'm talking to myself. I give chassan classes and my wife's like, why do you do that? I'm like, I really hope that what I'm saying hopefully will like penetrate into my thick skull and have an effect on me. If you want to listen, you're welcome to. If you have to be here, it is what it is. So 18 years ago in June, I got married in July, 18 years ago in June, I went to Florida. I had to take care of something, and my Rebbe, Rabbi Zweig, was giving a shiur on Shalom Bayis. Now, I had never heard a shiur on Shalom Bayis before. I was 21 years old, and I go to this house in Motzei Shabbos, the Perlansky home, and I sit down, I look at everybody around me, and I said, all these people have Shalom Bayis problems. And then Rabbi Zweig gets up there to speak, and I want you to know something. I can tell you thousands of his shiur, thousands. I don't know a word he said that night. I only know his opening line. His opening line was, you're probably sitting around here looking at everybody thinking everyone here has Shalom Bayis problems. Like, yes! He goes, but you're the ones who don't because you're willing to work on it. And that is such an awesome lesson that as long as you're willing to work on something, people don't have to work on whatever profession they're in. Of course they do. It doesn't mean they have a problem. That means you're willing to work on it. You don't have a problem. So that's the goal. The goal is to constantly work on it. Marriage is supposed to be something which is constantly, constantly working on. They say it's supposed to be like wine. Hopefully it doesn't sour. It's supposed to get better with age. So there's a pasuk, I cover the topic. It says adding kedushin to your kedushin. The pasuk in kedushin says, "Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe le'emur, daber al kol das bnei Yisrael, v'amartem kedushin to you should be holy." What does it mean to be holy? It says Rashi, "Havi perushim min arayas u min avera, separate from arayas and from avera." And the lesson that I take out of here is the following: you need to make your marriage separate from everybody else. You need to have things which are special to you and your spouse. What means special is that there are certain things that you just have just between you and your spouse. Now, obviously, hopefully, the only person in the world to give a diamond ring to is your wife. So that's why that's special. If you go around and do certain things or give certain things and act a certain way with everybody, then that act becomes less to your spouse. The more things you have that are special and unique to your wife, between you and your wife, the more special it is, and therefore the more special relationship it is. So if you give flowers to everybody, so then what do the flowers mean to your wife? So therefore, you have the ability to take something and make it special by limiting it between you and your wife. If you keep your eyes, you keep your mouth, you keep your ears, you keep everything that you have, whatever you can for you and your wife, that makes you and your wife's kadosh. It makes it separated from everybody else. You obviously have interactions with other people. I'm not saying you shouldn't talk to anybody. What I'm saying is that you want to take certain things and make them special. And by special, I mean separate from everybody else. And that's what makes your wife feel special. So one of the most important things I've learned tonight, what I'm going to share with you are things that I've learned from myself, from other people. I don't take much credit for the ideas as much as these things I've collected. Women want to feel valued by their husband. They want to feel loved. They want to feel beautiful to their husband. If the whole world thinks they're beautiful, the whole world thinks they're funny, but their husband doesn't, it doesn't mean anything to them. They get their sense of purpose and fulfillment from their husband, by their husband appreciating what they have. Therefore, that makes the woman feel loved and valued. When you appreciate a person, you're really giving them a reality, giving them life. If you walk into a room and you don't acknowledge a person, he feels ignored. You have people today where they'll say on their Facebook, whatever it is, I'm going crazy, I'm having a heart attack, I'm having a nervous breakdown, call me in 2 hours. They want to be acknowledged. They want to be recognized. When you recognize a person, you literally give them existence, you give them reality, you give them life. And you walk up to a person, if you ever know anybody, you don't have to be a world-famous person to you're complimenting you worth something. If you walk up to a person and say, you just know that was a really good speech, you just know that was a really good Dvar Torah, you just know that's a nice shirt, that's a great food that you made, your house looks really nice, that makes them feel good. That makes them feel good. And now if you multiply that by your spouse who's looking to feel fulfilled through you, the husband, that'll literally give them existence. There's another level of appreciation, and that is finding value in something that your wife values that you could care less about. For example, if you both like eating pizza and watching the Jets lose, okay, like what's the big deal, right? But let's say your wife likes window shades, and you could care less about that. You walk in and say, wow, the colors really match well. It makes her look so much nicer, and you can care less about it. See, if you like window shades, that's not appreciating something that's valued to her, because you also like window shades. But if you could care less about something, if you're a slob, okay, go raise your hand, and your wife's a neat freak, because you always have one or the other in a relationship. If you're a slob and your wife's a neat freak and you walk in and the house is like, and if you're a neat freak and your wife's a slob and the house is clean, you're thanking her, but you're not because you really want it for yourself. It's what she finds important. That's another level of appreciation. one of the hardest things in marriage is we live a life, you know, we live in the selfish life. We live in the selfie, all about me. As Ephraim Shapiro once said, you know, in the olden times, people used to eat kneaded loaf and rugelach and play with, what are those things called? Kugelach, which is about you. And today it's all about me. It's about Nestle and Bisley and broccoli. It's all about me, me, me. And we have to live in a world where we go into marriage thinking, what can I give instead of what can I take? And you all know if you've ever given up of something of yourself, whether it be your time, whether it be your money, whether it be your listening ear, whether it be an object or food that you have, to somebody you love or somebody you don't love, you know that the act of giving is much more fulfilling than the act of taking. And multiply that many more times when it comes to your spouse, where if we look, say, what could I take out of the marriage instead of what I could put into the marriage? So if you do that, first of all, your wife's going to feel appreciated if you look what you can give. And also, you ultimately are going to take more. My grandfather once said, you know, sometimes the Torah is illogical. That you think logically, if you take money out of your pocket and give it to someone else, you're less wealthy. The Torah says, Asa b'shvil shetes asher. You give tzedakah, you become rich, right? You take money out of your pocket. Instead of becoming less wealthy, you become more wealthy. When you give, instead of being less fortunate, less wealthy, you're actually more wealthy. You have a better feeling. There are times in my life that I remember from my young age that I did something like that, and it stays with you for a really long time, much more the time that you took the extra slice of pizza or whatever it is. One of the most important things, and I was talking to my chavrusi yesterday, Yaakov Spinner, about what I'm speaking about, and he told me to watch a clip from, I think his name is David Nakash. He spoke at the Torah Masorah Convention. You heard that clip? So this guy, his father apparently used to own some jeans company, Ford, I don't know, whatever it is. You know this is?
Jordache, right?
There we go. Yeah, so I never heard of it till this morning, but he spoke at the Torah Masorah Convention, and I'm going to take his speech in 28 minutes and do it about two or three, but his point was the following, that he was saying that the Balabatim have to learn more and enjoy it more. You have people who learn seriously in yeshiva and then go to work and then stop learning altogether or learn superficially. You know, your children know what's value to you. Your children know, I have a neighbor who is, I always joke when I make my bonfires late at night at my house, I say, be quiet, my neighbor's deaf, right? She's like an 80-year-old self-hating Jew, and she was having to marry to a Jew. She has one child who is married to a guy, and when her husband died, so he came from Chiflin, Florida, and he's wearing a wife beater, piercings, tattoos everywhere. His name is Randy, and I said to him, I said, do you want to say Kaddish for your father? So he looks at me and says, what's Kaddish? I said, well, when a Jew dies, he goes, my dad was Jewish? The guy must have been 50. He had no idea. Like, you have values you want to transmit to your children, whatever it be, honesty, integrity, whatever it is. Judaism, hopefully, is like somewhere there. It never made the top 50. It never made the list. He had no idea. Because it wasn't important to him. Your children know what your values are. If you come home, it doesn't make a difference what your profession is. I want to make that clear. If you come home talking about the stock market, you come home talking about a sports game, you come home talking about something physical, your kids know that's important to you. It doesn't mean it should be not important. But if you come home saying, oh, wow, I feel so good. I just did Tomchei Shabbos. I feel so good. I had a chance to help a person. The rabbi spoke between Milcha Marv today. He was awesome. I heard this great story. I heard this inspiring act of chesed. So when you walk into your house on fire from that, that sends a message to your wife and children. That's where your values are. Again, you could be a rabbi coming home talking about the sports game. You could be a doctor coming home talking about the rabbi's shir. It doesn't make a difference what profession you're in. When you yourself walk into your house and you show what excites you, what gets you going, what turns you on and makes you happy and looking forward to, you say, I have a Sunday, I can't wait to sit on the couch for 8 hours and watch football, or I'm going to watch football for 6 hours, but I can't wait to learn an hour in the morning, the hour in the afternoon. That sends a message to your child. When on winter break, they have a chance to go ahead and do some sort of act of tzedakah or chesed. You travel to make sure you don't miss a minute. Today with the internet, it's so easy to travel anywhere and not miss a minute. It's literally, you have to try not to. And because all Jews go to the same places, it's even harder to not get a minute. But that sends a message. That kedusha flows over into the entire family. Your wife sees that, your children see it. When your child goes to shul on Shabbos and he sees his father learning, or you see on Friday night when everybody's is exhausted, right? Instead of after going to sleep on Friday night trying to get a bagel, you know what a bagel is? 12 hours. Don't look at me like that. 12 hours, right? You say, I'm going to learn for an hour, I'm going to finish the parsha, I'm going to learn the blot. That sends a message to the kid. That very much sends a message to the kid when you're sitting on an airplane. Right, you don't have to watch 12 hours of whatever videos they're showing. You have an opportunity to show that to the child, and that very much has an effect on them. And when you try something that tastes delicious, that has a very much overflowing effect, because you want to try it again. I call it the great-grandmother perfume syndrome. I was lucky to have a bunch of great-grandparents in my life. My father's the first to get married in his family. My mother's the oldest in her family. And I was lucky to have four or five great-grandparents. One of my great-grandmothers, so I would go hug and kiss her, and she had this perfume that you're like, no, I'm never coming near you ever again in my whole life, right? And but that's like that anything in true. If you have an experience and it's enjoyable, you're going to want to go back to it again. And if you show that you're to your wife and children that living a Torah way of life is not a burden. Shabbos is not a burden. Yom Tov might be expensive, but I'm thrilled to do it. It's a lot of work, but I'm thrilled to do it. Right? They can say, I want to do it. But if it's a burden, say, who wants that? I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to go back to that perfume. There is a... Avram gets tested with the Akedah. And I'm not getting into all the other nine Nisyonos. I'm going with this one specifically. But at the end of the day, Yitzchak was Sarah's kid. Yitzchak was Sarah's kid also. Why is it that when Avram was tested with the Akedah, Sarah was not included? Why should it have been the test for Avram and Sarah? Was it both of their children? I believe that Rabbi Reisman said an unbelievable answer. His answer was the following, that, you know, there are people who go through difficult times in life. You're unfortunately having financial difficulties, God forbid someone's sick, you're having marriage problems, you're having your spiritual roller coaster. And my wife and I often speak about, unfortunately, the single parents who go through these difficulties, how much harder it is. Because when you work together with your spouse, that nisayon becomes a little easier. Not easy, easier. If you're having a difficult time, God forbid a child is sick, and it's either a single parent or they're not on talking terms, so it just makes it harder. But if you're working together with your spouse, it's the power of two. It's the power of two becoming one. That makes the nisayon a little easier. And had Sarah been included in the nisayon of the Akedah, it would have been a different test. Because it wouldn't have been the same test on Avram. Because he would have had his wife working with him. You know that when you're working together with your spouse, you can be 5,000 miles away from each other and feel like he or she is standing by your side. And you know that if you're not working well with your spouse, you could be sitting next to each other and you could feel 5,000 miles apart. There's a quote...
There's no way Sarah would have let him go through with it.
So they say Sarah's a bigger Nevi'ah than Avram.
Yeah.
And, I mean, to a certain degree, I don't know if any of you ever had a child go through a procedure or surgery, but one of my children had to get his tear ducts unclogged. And multiple of my children had to go then. And I took my child in, actually. And my wife's like, no. I'm like, are we having an emotional discussion here? This is what's got to be done. You know what I'm saying? Then they put the gas mask over my child, and he went from kicking and screaming to going... And my first reaction was, I got to do this at bedtime, right? But then it was scary watching a kid look lifeless. But my wife could have never handled that. So she let me do it. She didn't stop me. She let me take my kid in because even though emotionally, how are you going to let your child do that? But at the end of the day, if Sarah was a bigger Nevi'ah than Avram, this is not like your boss or your wife speaking. This is God. You know what I'm saying? God speaking to her. So maybe you're right. This is the answer that Rabbi Reisman gave, that when you work with your spouse, it has much more of a... It's a little less of a nisayon. And I heard a quote once, and I don't know where, but the quote is, closeness is a state of mind, not a physical reality. You can feel very close to your spouse, your children, and they can be very far away, because closeness is a state of mind. But you can sit next to a person who you don't know, don't like, and feel very distant. So you don't have to be physically touching to be close. You don't have to be physically far to feel distant from each other. Somebody spoke in Darche about 10 years ago, and somebody told me a story. He said it, a guy who works for Internet Awareness, and he said that there was a couple that was married for 13 years, that the man was having his difficulties and struggles, and he decided that he was going to look for pleasure elsewhere. And he went on the Internet and found a woman. He enjoyed the conversations with her, and he decided he wanted to meet her. He made up a date, made up a time, made up a place. The date comes, time comes, the place is there. He shows up, and who else shows up? His wife. Now, there's two very, very important lessons from that story. Lesson number one is that all the desires that he thought another person had, everything that he thought he was going to find in another woman, when reality was his wife. Meaning, you think the grass is green on the other side, it literally was on the other side of the door. But due to lack of communication, literally a door, he didn't get it. But there's another victim in the story. That's the wife. Wife is suffering also. When you don't have proper communication, you literally could be suffering independently the similar struggles. You could be suffering and thinking that your wife is not the right person. You're going to go ahead and find someone else. And everything that other person has, your wife has. Which leads on to another thing, that as you get to know your spouse, so you to a certain degree, see flaws and faults that they have. Part of appreciating a person is appreciating that every single person has 10 flaws. Every person has 10 flaws. And you think to yourself, you know what? I should have married someone else. Well, guess what? That other person also has. That person also has 10 flaws. For those of you who lease a car and get a new car every 2 or 3 years, and you're not happy with your old car, and you get a new car, you're trading in 10 flaws for another 10 flaws. That's what you're doing. The other car might not have the flaws, but you think about it, it's really a step further than that. That is, let's say your wife is a slob, and you say, I had to marry a neat freak. I can't handle that. But you realize that part of what makes of your wife being a slob, part of that mentality is the fact that she can now go, okay, let's go out for dinner, let's go away for a day, and she doesn't need 6 weeks of preparation to decide mentally, you know, where you're going. You just get up and go. A person who has the type A personality, OCD, can't necessarily make those decisions. So part of what makes you enjoy your wife is, to a certain degree, that flaw that she might have. So we look at a person and say, you know what, I wish I had X, Y, and Z. In reality, you're trading in one flaw for the next. What we're supposed to have is an appreciation for every person, understanding that every person comes with flaws, and it's trading one in for the other. In reality, it's just going to be trading in one flaw for the next. There is something Rabbi Yeager told me before I got married. And he says the following. He says, you're always supposed to what's called sandwich criticism with praise. Sandwiching criticism with praise means that, first of all, when you walk in your house, the first thing should never be negative, even if it's on your mind. Okay, hold it in. Never should be negative, first thing. But if for whatever reason you have to criticize, you sandwich criticism with praise means the first thing you say is a praise, the last thing you say is a praise, and the middle is a criticism. You realize when you're being criticized, you feel you're being attacked and you get defensive. So one of the best ways I heard to criticize is the following. Let's say, for example, you like your hamburgers rare, and your wife likes them well done, and she makes them well done. There's two ways you can say it. I don't like the way you made the hamburger, or I like hamburgers well done. I like hamburgers rare. What's the difference? What's the difference? If you're saying, I don't like the way you made the hamburgers, one you're attacking the problem, one you're attacking your spouse. The problem is always the problem is not your spouse. One, your wife feels like she's defensive, one is saying, okay, we have a problem to deal with now, we don't have dinner. Right, you're supposed to be home at 6 o'clock to go to your wife's best friend's wedding, which we all love doing, and you show up at 6:30. The problem is you're late, not the fact that your husband showed up late. The problem is the problem. You attack the problem. You don't attack your spouse. You sandwich criticism with praise, and you make it a scenario. I found that to be so helpful with children and students. I once asked one of my children who was having trouble davening. I said, you know, I have kids in my class who are struggling davening. What do you think I could do to help them? Now, I didn't attack him. I didn't attack him. Or I could do that to my students. About something for my child. I'll say, you know what? I have a child at home who has trouble getting up for shachar. So I have a child, what do you think? Meanwhile, they start to think about it and say, somewhere, it's in the brain, it's going to sink in and penetrate when that comes in. When I meet a chassan and kala, so I ask Rabbi Zweig, what's the most important? Give me one thing to tell them. So he says to me the following. He says, tell them when one of them is getting really worked up that they should, before they respond, repeat to their spouse what they said. Okay, repeat to the spouse what they said. What do you accomplish by doing that? You accomplish two things. Number one, you avoid an unnecessary fight. And number two is they know you're listening. So they say, no, that's not what I said. I said this. Now, what I'm about to tell you, I did not do on purpose, but it worked out really well. I was shopping in Bronx. I remember where I was standing in the far right corner near the small potato chip bags. And I have a shopping list. This is literally from my mother. I have a shopping list still that goes in according to the aisles of Bronx. That when you walk in our tins and then you have the meat, like literally you go up and down the aisles and check it off. So I'm with the list. My wife calls me up and she says, Yechiel, do you miss me? I said, yes, honey, I miss you very much. She said, I said, did you get Bisley? Now, imagine the following scenario. She says, do you miss me? I say, yes. I get home and she says, where's the Bisley? I'm like, never asked for it. But because I responded to her, and I said, and now Yanki Brach says to me, why in the world do you think your wife is asking me if she misses you, if you miss her while you're shopping? That's a kasha, that doesn't bother me. But when you respond back to your spouse, when she is very upset, you say, one second, so what you're saying is you're upset about, you know, your mother said this and this. That's not what I said. So now she knows you're listening, and you avoid an unnecessary fight. Why do you say I can't do that? I said you can. So when you respond back to your spouse, you avoid an unnecessary fight, and you let them know that you're listening. There's a famous story of the Rosh Hashanah Zalman Orbach, but I'm going to tell you the first part and the second part. The first part's very famous, but it's only to get to the second part. At his wife's funeral, he said the following. He said that it's customary for a spouse to ask mechila, but I can tell you in 53 years of marriage, we never had a fight, and therefore I'm not asking mechila. Now, I don't know your marriages or your parents, but that's amazing. That part's famous. A few months later, he sees a Talmud and says, Newhouse marriage was amazing. 6 months, not a single argument. So Shlomo Zalman says, is your wife alive? He goes, yeah. He goes, are you still married to her? Yeah. He goes, how do you go 6 months without an argument? He says, what do you mean? Rebbe said he went 53 years. He said, no, I didn't. He goes, yeah, I heard it at the funeral. He said, I went 53 years without a fight. An argument is a difference of opinion. It's the most natural thing in the world. For those of you who don't know, men and women are a little different, right? To have a difference of opinion is the most natural thing. Of course we have a difference of opinion. That's an argument. I never let that escalate into a fight. That's what it is. Marriage is what you don't have to agree on everything. It's just how you're going to work out the differences. You see, if you quote-unquote fight correctly, if you work your differences out correctly, the result is irrelevant and the process will bring you closer in the process. The process of working out that difficulty, where are you going for Yontif, where X, Y, or Z, if you work that out properly, the result will be irrelevant and the process will bring you closer to together. I once asked my father, my parents, you know, I didn't realize how great my parents' marriage was until I got married, because you grow up a certain way. Unfortunately, if you grow up with a dysfunctional parents, dysfunctional marriage, you don't know any better. And if you grow up with a great one, I never realized until my wife pointed out to me, my mother and father are very different. My mother's 5'3". She dresses every day like it's a black tie affair. She's got like the Energer bunny. She has a new car every 3 years. My father is 6'5". He's the quietest person I've ever met in my whole life. He wears jeans and a t-shirt. He drives a pickup. Every 10 years, he gets a new one. He gets the same model, same color, just 10 years newer, when it just doesn't drive anymore. And my mother has 7 refrigerators and freezers in her house. There's my mother, my father, and Maria. That's it. And when the house is bustling, my father walks in, my mother stops. I never noticed it. I never, because that's just the way I grew up. And you look at somebody else, there's somebody who lives in Muncie. Rabbi Zweig said this about him, and I know he was Rabbi Zweig's yeshiva. He said that he never heard a mother scream until he was 13 and in someone else's house. That's amazing. He never heard a mother scream until he was 13. So I just want to conclude with one more message and a story. Oh, sorry, 2 more messages. So I asked my father, how did he become the great husband that he is? So my father said he has something called the 6-month rule. Now, if you know my father, this is possible for him. It's very hard. And Talmidim have told me they've done it after I told them. When your spouse says something to you that you disagree with, stop and think, which makes you a tzaddik right there. Will I care in 6 months? Do you want to go for Chinese or pizza tonight? I really want pizza, but in 6 months I'm not really going to care. And if you do care, that means there's something wrong with the food, right? But where are you going to live? Where are you going to send your kids to school? That I'm going to care about. And if you're not going to care about 6 months, no problem. And you know what the advantage of that is? Is that when you do pipe up, everyone's going to listen, because they know you're not the person who's just background music and talking. So there is a quote I heard from Rabbi Storch: don't stop dating just because you're married. And that does not mean dating other girls. That's not what it means. What it means is that when you're dating, you are not as cheap. You make an effort to go find places that you would enjoy instead of just, you know, taking quick food to go. It means that you put a lot, much more effort into what you think and what you say and what you don't say, and you make much more of an effort. And for some reason, it's the opposite. Really, we should make less of an effort for the girl we're dating than our wife. I should make an effort for the girl you're dating, but you might marry her, you might not. Your wife, you are married to. We should spend much more money, time, and effort with our wife, and don't stop that mindset of dating just because you are married. So I want to conclude with a story from the Tolna Rebbe. Tolna Rebbe says something fascinating. He says that, that you know, under the chuppah, they break the glass. The reason why they break the glass is Zerichah L'Chorban. They want to remember the Chorban. And that's the peak of your happiness. Why do we want to ruin it? And he says that the message is the following. Everybody in life has tzaras. Some people have tzar gilo banim. Women say giving birth might be painful, I'm not sure. Everybody's got some sort of tzaras in life. But don't let that ruin the picture. When you look at your wedding pictures, you don't think about the difficulty of the chuppah breaking the glass when you remember the chorban. We wake up in the morning. That itself is a blessing. Not everybody wakes up in the morning. You wake up in the morning and you have your day and you're going to have your breaking of the glass. But don't let that ruin the picture. Right now, when you're starting your marriage, yeah, you can have ups and downs, but don't let it ruin the picture. And therefore, right at the peak of the height of your excitement, or the height of your happiness, let that message be known that we're going to still be filled with happiness, even though we're going to have those bumps along the road. Have an awesome rest of the day.
Thank you.